Well, okay, let's get started. As any number of places to start. This is like some poorly defined path integral. So we'll see what comes out. First of all, I'd like to say thanks to Niyesh for organizing this. He's the principal organizer. There was a nominal committee, but the rest of the committee didn't do anything. And That's right, you're on the committee too. See, we don't even know who we are. And what my observation is that I've been around Perimeter since 04, which is a couple of years after it started, and it started as a very sort of the mission is very interdisciplinary, and also as connoted by the name Perimeter, it was supposed to be sort of edgy, non-mainstream ideas, and I think over the years, it's people have occasionally worried whether or not Perimeter was becoming too specialized and siloed and more mainstream. And there has been some of that, but I think this meeting is very much in the spirit of the mission of the place, which is what was going on at the original Perimeter, which is people from different, with different sort of inclinations and different ideas as to what fundamental theory should be, would get together and occasionally talk to one another and try to learn something from other people. I would say, too, that this is probably why this is a difficult meeting sometimes for some of the junior people. You've heard this appeal from the old people quite a bit during this meeting that we want to hear more from the postdocs and the graduate students, and how come they won't talk? And I think the reason you want to hear more is because you're hoping to hear some ideas that you haven't heard 15 times already over the last 20 years. But I understand, and partly from talking to people, but just on reflection, that it's there's a lot to absorb. So we've had talks on just all kinds of things, different sorts of holography, some of them coming from string theory, causal sets, loop quantum gravity, and a bunch of philosophical talks, which are less technical, but less mathematically technical, but kind of specific in their own way to various concerns about reasoning and how we should even go about having a meeting like this. So that's a kind of a meta topic, which Doreen was touching on today. So there's a lot to take in, and I don't think, I can pretty confidently say that even the senior people in this room do not follow all of the talks in full detail. And that's kind of, but by going through this whole week, we have a much better idea, senior and junior people, of what other people are doing and how they're thinking about what we call quantum gravity. So I want to say a little bit about that, and then maybe hopefully this will instigate a discussion. I did notice there's a bit of a tension. I think it kind of came out in one of the holography discussions between people who want to calculate things. Sometimes these things are even observables. And people who are interested really more in defining a theory and understanding what the ontology of the theory is. People who really want to know what becomes of space-time at, say, high energy scales or short lengths. And to other people, that's not as important. And so sometimes there's a bit of inadvertent kind of talking. I don't know if it's talking past each other, but there's a kind of, people have different ideas in mind, and so their definition of success is different. So this comes up in holography a lot. There's a lot of neat ideas. There's kind of dual relations. Some of many in string theory in which and you're able to calculate various things. What does this have to do with space-time? What is a conformal field theory in the boundary, even if it's the boundary of an actual space-time that we live in, like De Sitter, which would not be the ADS-CFT correspondence. What does it tell you about the bulk? Well, you know, what do you want to know? And for some people, for if your interest, and like I think coming from the philosophical, from philosophy, a lot of my interest is in the nature of space and time. That's a primary interest, and it can be very frustrating to listen to somebody, you know, talk about something that doesn't address your primary interest. Interestingly, in earlier meetings that I've been to on quantum gravity, I don't know if this is a something about you know, where we are in 2023, or it's just the particularities of this meeting, but there was much more talk about background independence, okay, and that was a desideratum for a theory of quantum gravity. You didn't assume a background space-time. We're doing less of that now. There hasn't been a lot of talk about how to do quantum mechanics in the absence of a well-defined space-time background. And one thing I would flag that is actually kind of surprising to me is that almost nobody really questioned the applicability of quantum mechanics, standard quantum field theory, to quantum gravity. In the old days, as the old people know, one of the approaches was that people thought about was one sort of, it's many approaches, but one of the things that people thought was that maybe quantum fields, quantum mechanics or quantum field theory only emerges with classical space-time, or some variant of that, right? The quantum theory wasn't fundamental. And there are many ways to kind of get there. One is just, okay, we should call everything into question as we come down in scale. The other more interesting, but that's an interesting motivation, but there's a more specific motivation behind that question, which is that our use of quantum theory is kind of funny because usually, almost invariably, and this will be a nice thing to talk about maybe, we start with a classical theory, a classical action, or a classical Hamiltonian, and that's and quantize it. You know, as Francesca said, we put hats on things. And but quantization is, you know, two things. If quantum mechanics is fundamental, why didn't you start with quantum mechanics? And why do you start with the classical theory and then do something to it? And then the second one is that even if you decide that that's the way to go, quantization in some circumstances, there's a huge number of ambiguities. There's not a unique quantum theory that's associated with a single classical theory. We can have one Lagrangian, many different quantum theories that come out of it. In quantum field theory, this comes out in operator ordering issues. And also in the choice, we talked about this a little bit over lunch. It hasn't come up much at the meeting. But when you go to a quantum field theory, you have to choose a vacuum, right? And there's nothing, you can use the symmetries of a space-time to choose a vacuum. But it's something that's not really there. It's an issue that isn't there in the classical theory. So there's this general, I wanted to flag it here partially because I think it's potentially important and it hasn't come up very much. But yeah, one sec, Carlo, because Carlo would definitely have something to say about this. But it's interesting, right? Because you feel when you look at what people are struggling with in all of these programs, you think, well, what assumptions can we drop or change in order to move things forward? Carlo.
Couple of comments. Yeah. One super short, you mentioned why there's much less debate about background dependence. Debate were there when string theory only existed in background dependence, really long ago. Now string theory exists in some sense non-background dependence. So the fact that the tentative theories quantum gravity do not fix the background now has become accepted by the much larger.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's the first one. Second one is a little bit more.
Background independent or independent?
Is it in the same position of independent?
Alternate things with mind. They say that they do not have a fixed background. Which I agree, and it's fine, it's the right way to do it. Maybe there's some string theories in my mind, but I don't know why. It says different.
Well, I mean, I just want to understand when did that transition happen? Is that, I mean, what was the transition that made it background independent?
In the late 90s, there were some nice papers by Ashok Sen and Barton Zweibach, which proved the background independence perturbatively of space theory. So what they showed was if you work around some background, as you perturb to a nearby background, if the theory was consistent here, it would be consistent on the other background.
So that's perturbative.
Right. So they move from one to the infinite to background.
Right.
At the classical level, when we do supergravity, it's obviously background dependent the same way we do everything. So just the way you do gravity. So when you're looking with the classical limit or semi-classical limit.
Sure, but that's just GR plus stuff, right? But
that's right.
Yeah.
But
at the fundamental
Given the fundamental level, given the perturbative understanding that it worked, I think that was enough for us not to worry about it.
But it's also for your critics, right? That was a bit bigger of a step.
Okay. So the second point I wanted to make is a bit more, it's a message. I want to raise a point. The obvious problem with quantum gravity doesn't need to be repeated is that we don't have experiments directly.
Yeah, and I want to touch on that. Good. Yeah.
So because of that, I think we have to take that seriously because of that, we're in a peculiar situation where the risk might be the opposite of what. There are various tentative theories of quantum gravity. Now, in history, it's normal that there are various tentative theories of what is not being understood.
What did you say? Sorry, I didn't.
In history, it's a normal situation that there are various tentative theories.
Yeah, okay, good.
When Maxwell wrote his equations, there were four or five theories of electromagnetics out there, okay? Mm-hmm. And people were debating which one is good, which one is bad, on various reasons. And then there were experiments, and somehow the crucial one was in waves, of course, but the you can produce waves, electromagnetic waves.
Mm-hmm.
And Maxwell's theory turned out to be right. At the time, the Maxwell equations were horrendously complicated. If you look at the treatise, two pages of horrendous equation, there was no. So the mathematics was far from clean. That was before Jackson.
Even before Jackson, yeah.
But then there were experiments. When Bohn and Jordan wrote the paper PQ minus QP equal IH bar, okay, every mathematician would have said, come on, just take the trace, these are matrices, trace of PQ is equal to trace of QP, so the left hand side is zero, the right hand side, the trace of the identity, could be everything but not zero. So that's obviously mathematical nonsense, right? It took a long time for Neumann, trace class operators, blah, blah, to figure out what the hell was going on. People were working with matrix theory and similar problems with the Schrödinger thing. And of course, at some point, the measurement clearly indicated that this is very good, this work. So imagine there were not the measurements.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I'm saying, which could be a plausible situation. There's nothing wrong with that, because that's humans and limited humans. Imagine that somebody would have said, oh, there are all this Maxwell theory, other theory, other theory, other theory. We can decide, therefore, all this is shaping some new radical ideas. Imagine that there weren't the experiment with the spectra sufficient, quantum mechanics matrix is just mathematically not clean, and Schrödinger theory is not clear what it means. So forget about that, we need some radical ideas. That would have been nonsense. Oh, perhaps we need some radical ideas. But this repeating things. Oh, we need some radical ideas. Everything which is on the table is not good just because there's no consensus. It's fine there's no consensus. That is possibility. Theories are unclear, but helpful to dismiss string theory, I'm saying that, incredible. or the other theories around, just because we don't have empirical confirmation of this, or because they're not mathematically clean.
Right.
So what I'm saying is that there's a lot of rhetoric about, oh, quantum gravity means something completely radically different, which is, it might be true, what do I know? But it might be completely wrong. And maybe we just have to study causal dynamic attenuation of string theory to quantum gravity better and find ways to compare to cosmologists, to physics and things, or laboratory experiments, until we can choose better.
Right. Okay. Yes, I can imagine many responses, and here are two. Rob, and then Niels.
Well, I was going to make a comment about a different thing. You said you didn't hear anybody question quantum mechanics, but in one of the sessions,
Lee, I missed Lee, who just walked in, did. But and who are you going to mention?
If I could continue, in one of the sessions. It was stated that, because I know I stated it, that maybe gravity isn't quantum and that we should spend, more people should spend more time trying to make something that is quantum matter and non-quantum gravity. And I know there are arguments against that, but we also don't really have a quantum theory of gravity everybody's happy with. So it seems that warrants some measure of attention. Concerning experiments, yeah, that's hard, but people are doing experiments seeing if entangled objects freely fall the way unentangled ones do. So far, so good, if you think good is that they do. But nevertheless, I regard that as new empirical information. It's not a priori guaranteed that that would have happened, for example. Right. So we do what we can. The third comment I have regarding generalizing quantum, or questioning it, it's very hard to do. It's very hard to come up with something that modifies quantum significantly in a way that doesn't fall apart. Whereas gravity is easy. I mean, Einstein's equations, there's all kinds of ways of expressing curvature as a function of energy. You can break invariances. I mean, gravity is fungible in a way that quantum seems not to be. And I think that's why people question the latter much less.
Good. Lee, do you want to comment on that before I go to Niels?
I showed you two ways to do it.
Right, and I was speaking with painted with too broad a brush. I mean, it did come up, but it was not a dominant theme. But Niels, you had something.
I just wanted to defend radicalism a little bit. For one, I think it's conservatism is the way of the old, and it's the way that older people establish their territory, because that's how they get there. So I think one thing is the new order would require some level of radicalism. But the other thing is, at least from my perception, the chasm between what we observe, which is, as Carlo agrees, is what we want to explain, and all these proposals for quantum gravity, I think, is so wide that just making that leap requires a radical step. Maybe it's a leap from the known proposals, or maybe a leap from something very different, but that's such a wide gap right now that I feel, you need a radical approach. Now, whether it's based on what we know or something completely new, so something radical, a big leap is needed. That's what I think.
Right. Was there somebody? Yeah, there was a couple.
Yes, I would like to. Yes. I agree with what Carlo said completely. I think I would like to add another aspect to this, which is the situation that theories are so difficult that it takes so long to complete them, or to come to a situation where you can actually make clear predictions. And I would think that something similar to what Carlo said also applies to this situation, that there is no clear epistemic significance of such a situation. While there is clear epistemic significance of the theory, let's say, contradicting data, so that's probably a false theory, and we need something new, or a theory that is internally inconsistent in a clear way, there is no clear epistemic message coming from a theory being so difficult that it takes awfully long to complete it. Now, of course, one may at some stage come to the conclusion that maybe some substantially new way of viewing that theory is required in order to move forward. But it's not clear whether moving forward should play out within that theory or outside.
Right. So is the point that that the historical analogy is incomplete because of the early successes of quantum, sort of rough and ready electromagnetism and quantum theory and explaining data that we don't see in quantum gravity? Is that Carl is making a historical analogy, and you're pointing out the disanalogous elements.
I would say there is some kind of disanalogy, but there is also an analogy. There may be, it may be the case in some context that it was easier to complete theories earlier on than it is today, but the difference, it's not clear that there is an epistemic message in that difference.
Okay, gotcha. Doreen?
I was going to pick up on the idea of it's like the need for somehow both radical changes, like radically new ideas, but also like using what we have, right? And how, and Carlo made this comment earlier, you can do both things simultaneously, right? So I think one of the radically new ideas would have to be the emergence of space-time, right? And so I'm thinking about Chris's talk too, and other talks too about, and then this raises the question of like how the radically new ideas come in, and if you could start by like trying to do some sort of like correspondency thing and then not really understanding what you're doing, right, and how to interpret it until maybe you're quite a ways along, and it could turn out that the most radical new concepts take a long time to understand after you have some sort of working formal operational understanding of what's going on. I mean, that could be one way it goes.
Anybody else on this? I'm going to belatedly write the topic on the board. Carlo, and then back. I thought you had your hand up. Chris, yeah, and then back to Rob if you want.
Yeah, so I was going to say that the I think in addition to looking, it's difficult to find any clear experimental signatures, but the taking the existing theories and extrapolating them like math is perhaps the best way to generate those kinds of experimental signatures. And that's one of the things that I've appreciate about the cosmology talks is that you're basically taking a very simple 6-parameter model that allows you to tie together the CMB measurements and local universe measurements. And that might reveal something. I mean, I think it's still a question of whether what we've discovered is that one area has more systematic errors that we haven't fully come to grips with rather than discovering new physics. But it's by taking that model seriously that you can leverage all the information we currently have to try to turn up anomalies that will be revealing of something. So I think it's, you really should take the current physics really seriously and use that to try to find discrepancies or residual phenomena. I mean, I think that's what people have already done, and it's just so challenging in quantum gravity, even if you take the physics seriously, to find these sorts of telling pictures. But that's what I see happening in cosmology, that you're taking the model very seriously and you're learning a ton. I mean, it might not always be that you're learning about theory. You might be discovering all kinds of really interesting features about the local universe by doing so. But you might also end up discovering something about the theory.
Right. And this is the CMB you're talking about.
Yeah, well, the CMB and the local. So the fact that the supernova measurements and the CMB are interestingly linked is just because we have the model. So that we're looking at one. We're looking at the expansion history in one model and looking at two ends of that, and we only get a conflict if we assume that the model holds. And
got it. Okay. Who is next? Rob quickly, and then Astrid. We're going to go back to people who haven't been heard from.
I agree with Doreen. I don't think it's either or. Radical new ideas while pushing the other ones, but the problem with radical new ideas is if they're not calculable, they don't get much traction. And this is strongly influential in the discipline. And I think it's why people shy away from them. Unless they can see something to calculate readily and immediately, most won't do it. It's very hard to argue students should do it because it just won't lead to fruitful employment. And I know there are people in this room that would say, oh, Rob, it shouldn't be this way, blah, blah. But that is what I observe sociologically, for good or ill. There need to be things that people can compute in some reasonable time, or you know, you only get very rare people that don't care about this or that are financially insulated from the rest of the world or something to do it. So I think this erodes the trend toward radicalism.
Okay, good. Astrid?
Yes, I want to argue against this point of view that is often stated that we don't have experimental data on quantum gravity. I don't think that's true. We do have a ton of data that we can use to check our ideas of quantum gravity against, and that's everything that we know about what gravity looks like at low energies and what matter behaves like at low energies. The challenge is that in many approaches to quantum gravity, it's really tough to make the connection and find out what does the emergent low energy theory look like. As an example, we still don't know whether string theory does or does not give us the standard model. But if it doesn't, that's a very, very strong check, and we can immediately say that theory doesn't work because it doesn't agree with all of the particle physics data that we have. And so I would say that the challenge is not so much the availability of experimental data. The challenge is just a calculational or a technical one to make that connection from a given quantum theory of gravity to what it actually says about compatibility with the standard model. And so I think that this focus on, well, trying to find new experimental signatures of quantum gravity is sort of misleading. Of course, it's sort of much more appealing to come up with a new smoking gun signature of quantum gravity that no other theory predicts, and it's much less appealing to put in a lot of hard work to check all of the properties of the standard model. But I think if we as a community would start doing that more seriously, then we would be able to select out quite a few of the quantum gravity proposals that we have.
Okay, work harder. Lee, and then...
I had a direct follow-up.
Oh, okay, go ahead. Yeah.
So I'm curious, I agree with you, but I think there's different ways of qualifying what we mean by quantum gravity evidence. So, for example, do we have any evidence about high energy effects in quantum gravity there's so much that you'd have to recover in order for a quantum gravity. So like if you accept inflation, you have a quantum gravity effect of the amplification of the density fluctuations, right? So I think there's a lot of things that you could say are in one sense a quantum gravity effect that you'd want to recover, potentially if you agree with inflation, but there is a more restrictive sense of high energy quantum gravity, and I'm curious whether you think we have any evidence for that.
No, so I would say it's precisely not about, you know, sort of quantum gravity signatures in that sense, mm-hmm. but it's the fact that whatever fundamental microscopic theory we have at larger scales, it must be used to everything that we know. Right? So this is not it's a way to rule a lot of theories out, right? In this way, you will not be able to say, this is our theory of quantum gravity, because the only thing that you can say, well, it will be that it is a theory that is compatible with low energy observations. It's a way of ruling theories out.
I'm very sympathetic with that. Correspondence is a concern.
Lee is jumping out of his chair. Yeah, so.
Well, I'm confused because I don't hear any mention of the fact that we in the quantum gravity gave precise predictions for the areas of surfaces, precise spectra, and precise predictions for the volumes, the spectral volumes, and many things like that. And people are acting as if this didn't happen. These are definite quantum gravity predictions. They are made, they are precise. And I'm surprised that people talk as if the physical exist. Of course, it's hard to test, but let's separate that from the fact that it's straightforward to calculate them. And they exist, and we can work with them.
Carlo, you guys did this work, so.
Of course,
not everybody knows that, but.
Predictions for gravity, it's hard to get to. To test them, I also really ask that we have a lot of empirical information about quantum gravity. That's what I was saying in the previous session. But what I wanted to, I raised my hand to comment about radical and radical discussion.
Right.
Maybe not.
So our radical is arguing against radicalism.
Yes.
I don't want to preach on what should be done and not should be done, but I want to say how I've seen the quantum gravity problem regarding radicality. And I have always thought, and I might be wrong, that a very good model to have in mind was Einstein's special relativity, because it's a remarkable combination of two things. On the one hand, it was an astonishing radical idea that simultaneity doesn't make sense physically, so it's just a revolutionary way of rethinking the world. On the other hand, it was Einstein got there by taking Maxwell's equation very seriously, and not thinking there's a contradiction with relativity, therefore we should change them, and taking relativity very seriously, and not thinking there's a contradiction, therefore relativity should, it's wrong, okay? So he got there, not by discarding or changing the old theories, but by taking the old theories seriously. So, and he, in a sense, he did the same with general relativity, in a sense, Copernicus did something similar. I mean, there's many historical examples. Of course, there are many examples, different ways of doing science. But that way of doing science that reads out from what we have learned about the world, something, okay? Quantum mechanics, I believe, is something we have learned about the world. So of course, it might be wrong. And let's see what we learned from it. And general relativity, general coherence, partial independence, blah, blah, blah. And if you take them seriously, it seems like exactly like Einstein. It implies something dramatically radical, because there's no space in which things are emerged. There is maybe, you disagree with me, but there's no time a priori in which things evolve. You can only talk about relational things. So you get to a remarkably radical, I mean, look what that is, a remarkably radical rethinking of basic physics. You think about space and time, and observation, and relation in a completely different manner. But not out of the blue. Oh, let's be radical and think that, you know, there are little angels coming mm-hmm. from the sky. Being radical by trying to take apparently contradictory things we have learned about the world, Maxwell equations and relativity, and juggle until they get together. But they get together at the price of changing something else in our understanding about reality. And that I think, is the kind of radicality. Seems to be, I may be wrong, but that has a chance to be a good way of learning something new about the world on the basis of something we know, not just by guessing.
So, Carlo, do you think that the predictions of the spectra are
I think that predictions about the spectrum of area and volume are super radical because they tell us that we cannot think about the continuous space in which things have emerged. There are definite predictions, and my hope is that we can find some indirect way of confirming that in some way.
The direct consequences of quantum mechanics in general.
Yeah, I think it's a direct consequence. The way you think about it is that, look, we have learned that the metric, the space-time shape, the space-time geometry, it's a field. Oh, that's fact. We've learned. I believe it now. I may be wrong, but I think it's something we've learned. And we have learned that fields are quantum fields, so they're in a very simple sense. They're represented by operators that might not commute, and we can get their algebra from the dynamics themselves. So that means that these are operators, these are the spectrum, the computer spectra, bingo, here the R is this thing. And this can be measurable. This is a definite prediction that contradicts things we knew based on pieces of.
Got it. Okay.
There is a question online.
Great. Okay, Ed, just can you identify yourself? And
Yeah, sure. It's Andrew Richards. Hang on. There we go. There I am in the sunshine.
I don't see you. I'm not sure why, but yeah, but yes. The voice is enough. Sorry.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Can you see me okay?
No,
we can hear.
We can hear though.
Yeah.
Okay, so let me go over here. Excuse me for just 1 minute. From time to time, we have army helicopters. I'm in the country, come and land, and there's one coming over my house right now. It'll be gone in 2 seconds. Sorry about this. Oh, yeah. There they go. Okay.
There we are. We got your visual.
Good.
All right.
That might put in the picture. Okay.
Okay, so, go ahead.
Thanks. Radical new ideas. A comment. First of all, thank you very much for allowing me to participate in this conference. It's been wonderful. Lots of good thought going on. I've really enjoyed it. A quick bit of background, just to put a, it'll come into this, what I'm about to say. My background, I started in humanities, and later in life, I did an engineering degree. When I did, I had to do prerequisite courses. A professor asked me at the time, I asked them, what is gravity? They said they didn't know. That was 26 years ago, and I've been thinking about that ever since. Now I'll switch to something else. While all that was going on, I've worked in change management all around the world. That's really my expertise, is change management. And I think this is a really interesting question that you're bringing up, because what I worked in change management is breakthrough thinking in particular. And always, no matter where I worked, and working with people, always working with groups, I always made sure that in that group was somebody who knew nothing about what we were talking about. And it was amazing how many times they asked the question that cracked it open. We would get the most unqualified person, or theoretically, but they would look and say, why do you do it this way? And everyone would sit there and go, ugh. And this comes back. Now, the point that Chris made the other day, I think, is important too. And I think, Chris, the point you were trying to make is to use the body of knowledge and improve that forward. And there's a huge baby in that bathwater, and that should be respected. I think it's not, the conversation came a little bit at times to either or. Should we take a radical new view, or should we work with the body of, within the body of knowledge? And my thought on it would be, maybe for to think about, is it's not a question of either or, it's a question of percentage. You don't want to spend 90% of your time working, taking ideas that are not novel and not helpful. But you do want to make sure you spend about at least sort of around 5% of the time being open to radical ideas and making sure that they're in there. Ideally, they're novel and useful. And I have to say, I've written a book about gravity. I'm not here to plug it. What I am here to tell you is that I'm one of these crackpots that you're talking about. Once a day this week, someone has mentioned the crackpots, and I've laughed. I've taken it the right way. I laugh, and I can completely understand it. You can be overwhelmed. Everyone's got great new ideas. There was a comment made right at the beginning of this conference was somebody said that they were tired. I read it down. Hearing from people who say they know all about everything with their latest theory of everything. The interesting part to that is if someone ever finds a theory for everything, guess what they're going to know?
What?
Can anyone answer that? If somebody finds a theory for everything, guess what they're going to be able to explain?
What?
I'm guessing the answer.
The answer to that is everything. Think about that for a minute.
Yeah.
Okay. So my point would be, there's a lot of bathwater. There's usually a baby in it. Sometimes there can be a lot of bathwater and a little baby. Sometimes a big baby and not much bathwater. Anyway, that's my point. It's really a question, I think, of percentage and being open to radical ideas. Okay.
Thank you. Yeah. And I just want to tie that in. I mean, I think this is part of why, you know, we're trying to encourage participation from people who haven't been working in this field for, 15 or 20 years, younger people, because you're a source of not just new ideas, but untainted perspective, okay, coming at things new. Yes, and Akin, you've had something for a while. So.
Thank you. I'd like to make a bit of a philosophical point and maybe a radical one.
Are we allowing that at this conference? Philosophical point?
50%.
50% philosophical, okay.
Right. Let us look at the theory of computation, which is essentially the theory of problem solving. Mm-hmm. Here we have a problem in our hands, problem of finding a theory of quantum gravity. Now, there's something interesting that came out of the theory of computation, which is that you can try to solve your computation, your problem solving algorithmically, but there's a completely equivalent way of solving problems, which is through adiabatic computing. Now, every problem that you can solve with algorithmic method, you can also solve by reformulating it as finding the ground state of a Hamiltonian. Mm-hmm. So given a problem, there's a Hamiltonian whose ground state is the solution. And so that's how D-Wave operates. It's adiabatic quantum computing.
Yeah.
Right? If you do it quantumly. Now here we have a problem. We have the problem of finding the theory of quantum gravity. Maybe there is a Hamiltonian for that. Whose ground state is the theory we are looking for. Sure. Now what is that Hamiltonian? What is that process that gets us to that ground state? Now part of it is us here.
Yeah.
Right? Because we are Hamiltonian, you know, it's a system, and we're trying to find the solution to quantum gravity. We're kind of doing that. We're kind of trying to find that ground state, we're trying to find that solution. So in a sense, it's a situation like, what I want to say is this. Ordinarily, when we speak of a cake, we think a cake is one thing. Talking about the cake is something completely different. Quantum gravity, well, what nature does in the quantum gravity is regime is one thing, us talking about it is something completely different. But what we see from the theory of computation is that problem solving is finding the ground state of Hamiltonian, which is physics. Right? So in that sense, talking about quantum gravity, trying to find the solution to that problem can be formulated as a physics problem itself. I wonder what that Hamiltonian is.
Well, yeah, this is interesting. It goes in a number of different directions. And I'm wondering kind of what do you think of the, are you suggesting this is an interesting implication and that they kind of, the dialogue in the room and the noise in the room is analogous to, say, a temperature? This is adiabatic quantum computing, similar to, or do you think that there's an actual procedure we should be following? Like, in other words, you can imagine using some sort of artificial intelligence to help us explore the space of theories. And that's what you're doing here in this example, right? This is the landscape of the energy landscape is kind of the space of theories, and you're trying to optimize.
I do not know how to translate that philosophical point of view into a practical method.
Okay.
But I think what this view is about is this. Ultimately, what's happening with life in the universe is that the universe is becoming aware of itself, right? That's what's happening, evolution and then intelligent organisms. We study nature, and since we are part of nature, it's really the universe becoming aware of itself.
Mm-hmm.
And the theory of computation tells us how to put some meat to this and not just use words to say something like that, but the theory of computation tells us that problem solving is itself a physical problem.
Right, okay, good, thank you.
Yeah.
That's
my question. You said yourself what undermines it with the radical is what I said later. You don't have a practical way of going about it, so it doesn't help. This is the problem. I mean, sure, if people knew what the Hamiltonian might even be, you can bet everybody and his cousin would be trying to minimize it to find the ground state. The reason why they don't do it is there's no obvious procedure.
Still, it's good to know that there is one Hamiltonian.
Well,
and what is its role?
Well, it's not clear to me, given the lack of any procedure, that actually what you say is correct in this instance. It may be correct, but it's equally plausible that something's been missed and it's not.
Well, if the problem of finding quantum gravity is a problem that is amenable to computation,
for example, yeah,
then there is a Hamiltonian.
Yeah, but maybe not.
It's a problem.
But I want to make another comment with data, discrete A in volume. Lots of quantum gravity theories predict all kinds of things. Three generations from Calabi-Yau in string theory, for example. The problem is you want predictions that are accessible to empiricism within some foreseeable future. So that's the disconnect. It's not that there aren't predictions, it's that there aren't predictions that connect, the way Aspirin said, to what we can
comprehend. Right. Okay, Francesca has
a reaction
Can we use the proper names? Can we get the help of philosophers to use proper name from the proper things? So generations of particles has nothing to do with, it's not quantum gravity. Where is gravity there? Those are particles, are matter fields, right?
It was a prediction in string theory in the nature of the compactified geometry. So that's a connection to gravity.
Well, yeah, we haven't touched on this, and this is the role of unification in this whole enterprise. So,
yeah.
Right.
And I can also suggest that shall we drop a theory of everything from when we talk about unified theory of fundamental interactions, because it's so misleading, it's philosophically charged, and we want to get rid of that in scientific discussion.
Right.
Maybe.
Right, so your point being you could talk about unifying the four known forces without talking about the theory of everything.
Yeah,
yeah. Okay, gotcha.
The problem to say predictions for the foreseeable future, I interviewed many of the people who were at the Nuffield conference in 1982, and none of them thought that they would measure those fluctuations. Well, that's what they told me. So they would have said that's not on the horizon at all, but yet.
Yeah.
The CMB
fluctuates.
Yeah.
They're all theorists, aren't they?
Exactly.
I mean, they're trained by anisotropies in the CMB. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, the experimentalists would have known. Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
I just wanted to go back a little.
Sure.
Just a comment on what Achim said. So, that reminds me of some people have this idea, you know, that you can describe the universe as being in some quantum state. And then it's evolving using some unit theory. There's some, you know, some computation going on there. But again, there it has this similar nature where there's nothing to do the computation other than what's inside the universe anyway. So the thing that is in a state and the thing that is doing the computation on the state is the same thing. So that's in a similar spirit. Maybe we can discuss how does that make sense.
Yeah,
I'm trying to make sense.
Right. I mean, this is so that's come up. Well, it came up before, but I mean, this is something that's often remarked on and in different ways. So what do you think the implications of that for how we should go forward are? Do you think it's a limit on our ability to construct these theories that we're in the universe and that we're, you know, we're constrained physically, computationally by the fact that there are certain laws hold? What do you think do you have a...
Well, my intuition about it, I don't know, but my intuition about it is that it tells us something. That like not every structure that you can think of, mathematical structure, has this self-referentiality. And that's like a hint towards what...
Okay, good. Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
Can I...
Yes, sure, yeah.
So the point I was making in my talk that when we do... So if we wanted to talk about the wave function of the universe, this wave function is not a wave function of everything. It's a function that describes just a few degrees of freedom. And there is a clear separation between the degrees of freedom that are measured and the degrees of freedom that corresponds to observer. So it's not that it's a system that is measuring itself. So we can make a partition and apply the standard quantum theory. I think there is a confusion, again, thinking about cosmology as a theory of everything, and thinking about cosmology as a theory of a certain degrees of freedom. And the two things, what we do when we do cosmology is a theory of few degrees of freedom. And the idea that we can describe everything is maybe nice to be entertained philosophically, but it's not a scientific theory.
Got it, okay. Yeah, I think in a minute I want to go around and see what other subject we should be talking about before we stop. I mean, we haven't exhausted this. So who was next?
Robert?
Did you have your hand?
Robert.
Go ahead.
Several people have been talking about lack of observable, lack of concrete signatures of quantum gravity. I think I've heard many people bemoaning this, so let me just throw out the idea that dark energy will be a signature of quantum gravity.
Yeah, well. Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know if this will be realized, but I think this is something that we should aim for.
It might be.
Yeah. So this would be a huge success of the field if we could measure it, because we would have expended 70% of the energy in the universe.
And the same dark matter.
Well, but you're talking about analogies, and I mean, this reminds me that, I mean, the cosmological constant problem, that version of the dark energy problem, is the ultraviolet catastrophe of the era of quantum field theory. Carlo doesn't like that analogy, anyway, that's it. You could say that, and I did, Ted.
I wouldn't put it on the same footing as.
Okay.
Just because, I mean, the ultraviolet catastrophe of thermodynamic equilibrium of radiation was like an unavoidable catastrophe. The vacuum energy being large is not a problem at all, because we can just use unimodular gravity and we have an integration constant that sets the cosmological constant. The problem is...
You could set it to zero. Yeah. Yeah.
We could set it to anything.
Yeah, sure.
The problem is...
Well,
Robert objected to my statement about this earlier in the meeting.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I thought the problem was that, not that it's big, but that it's so sensitive to every physics, including, as Cliff Burgess pointed out, the mass of the electron, and also during cosmological evolution, a phase transition would change the vacuum energy by an amount that's way too big if it had been small earlier. Is that kind of a problem?
So I reiterate my fundamental objections.
Can you explain why?
Do you want to do that like verbally or?
Just come back to what you said.
Yeah.
There's one round state, that round state has one constant, that's coming to constant. Where it is. Everything is built from top.
And what happens during phase transitions?
The constant doesn't change. It is, we go to the ground state, whatever the ground state has, it has.
No, but the thing is, we're tumbling through phase transitions as the universe expands. Why are we going to land on the bottom? Why did we land today at such a small value, given that it changed by so much during previous phase transitions?
Because of thermodynamics, you go down.
Okay, but so I wouldn't characterize this situation as a catastrophe. That's really the only point I wanted to make.
Yeah, got it. Okay, good. Yes.
Quick,
yeah, go ahead. Yep.
The ultraviolet, traditional old-fashioned ultraviolet catastrophe is still with us if we believe the gravity is classical, because why would gravitational waves not have an ultraviolet divergency of the old kind if they're just like electromagnetism?
Right,
so
right.
That would need to be explained. Another thing to follow up on.
Lee commented on that earlier.
Because
you can't make equilibrium of gravitational waves, because you can't make a box that will hold them and let them equilibrate. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if that's relevant to it.
No, but they would suck up a lot of entropy. They would suck up a lot of heat. If the ultraviolet modes were not suppressed by quantization, then they would all want to have a KT.
Yeah, but the argument is you can't set up a system where they would be confined and lead to a problem. They wouldn't equilibrate with the other stuff in your system. They would just escape. Anyway, that's enough.
Yeah, well, right, I understand, yeah.
I wrote a paper on that, by the way, where we showed that what saves us in this regard is that the coupling to gravity is so weak. So even though every mode of gravity, even the highest ultraviolet, all want to have a KT in equilibrium,
yep.
It's coupled so weak that in the 13.8 million years, they would still not have accumulated much.
Oh, okay.
But what I wanted to add is a little bit about experimental accessibility of quantum gravity. And I think inflation is probably our best guess, because the fluctuations of the inflaton field or the Lukanov variable were frozen in only about like 4 or 5 orders of magnitude away from the Planck scale, which means that there is a chance that there's an imprint of Planck scale physics in the CMB, and in structure formation, that's only about 5 orders of magnitude suppressed. And that's much better than accelerator physics or anything else I know of. I mean, does anybody know anything that's closer to quantum gravity than that? It's very hard, of course, to measure the CMB to, 5 more digits behind the comma.
Yeah.
But it's easier than increasing the LHC to,
sure. Yeah. Okay, we keep, we're a lot of the same people. Does anybody want to, we have about, what do we have, half an hour or, how, when do we go to?
I mean, I have 3:30 in the schedule, but I think if we run out of steam sooner,
Let's follow this a little bit more, and then I do want to solicit other ideas about things that we should be, general topics that have to do with maybe what we should be doing for the next 5 years in quantum gravity.
I'll follow up on
it. Me too.
Okay. Follow up questions.
Finger.
Okay, I'm going to have to go with Francesco for Carlo.
Sorry.
Yes.
No, it's a follow up from what Akim was saying regarding looking for quantum gravity signature. And it's true that when we look for quantum gravity effects, we look for very high energy density, very short scales, and so on. But there is something that we are forgetting in this picture, and that is the time scale. So, for instance, for black hole, something we have to keep in mind is not just the curvature that you can have on the horizon that could be very small, but also how much time you wait, how much time you have available, so that quantum effects may pile up. But in the same way in which you may have particles inside an atomic nucleus that stay confined for a very long time, but if you wait a time long enough, they may tunnel outside. Mm-hmm. In the same way in quantum gravity, if we can access sufficiently long timescales, so there could be quantum effects that have the time to manifest themselves. So this could be true for black holes. It could be true also for cosmology. I think Robert the other day was mentioning to me so-called quantum break time that Jeff Valley has been...
quantum what?
Quantum break... Oh, is it?
What is it?
Quantum break time.
Break time.
So it's exactly this concept of how much time you need to wait for a system that is behaving classically to manifest quantum effects. And I think that the way, so when we have to look for quantum gravity effects, this is maybe a direction in which we can go. Think in terms of very long time scales, so that this could be the door to access quantum gravity signatures.
Good.
For those who are not familiar, so the quantum break time is analog to the page time.
Carlo?
I wanted to comment. I was a bit surprised to see the agreement between Ted and Akim. It seemed to me that they were actually agreeing. And Robert also, in the sense that everybody was saying the same thing, namely, even with different ideas and this possibility, there might be ways to see quantum gravity effects. We don't have clear evidence for one. Somebody has a it's more pointed on one, somebody more pointed on the other, but it's the same thing. And in particular, Akim mentioned that the ultraviolet catastrophe, of course, was strong evidence historically for the weakness of quantum mechanics. And I remember Ted Jacobson in Marseille or the Calag telling me, look, the fineness of the entropy of a black hole is exactly the same, can be taken exactly the same evidence for the discreteness of the geometry at small scale, which I think is. Very good point. I mean, I'd be wrong, but also there are a lot of this possibility that things we actually observe are. My talk I mentioned dark matter, but if it is true that the greater of the area stabilizes the remnants, the white hole remnants, then we already have big evidence for quantum gravity, which is dark matter. These are the remnants. Of course, it's an hypothesis, it's been tested. But I think there are a lot of indications, and this I agree with Astrid, there are a lot of partial things that we know already, there's no supersymmetry, and things that we might understand better out there that tell us that some of the ideas we have about quantum gravity, discreteness of others, are right or wrong. There's a lot of work to be done with these ideas.
Good. All right, so that's the end of the comments on this thread. Okay, what are we leaving out here? Once again, an opportunity for the graduate students either just questions of clarification or suggestions for future research areas, or why the hell aren't we trying this, whatever. Yeah.
I have a question about like radicalism and what is like quantum gravity community doing, like in order to allow everyone to have that like that freedom to try to do like different things, because I think that it's not only like I think that something that was said is like very important, that is that as a student maybe you cannot work in. Like maybe you don't know enough about like the whole history of physics to decide what is like the theory that you really believe in or the theory that you really think is what you want to develop. But also, and like you need to get a postdoc after your PhD. But I think that it's not only that, but that something that happens in physics is that we don't care enough about like how inclusive is that community, and like how the discussions are carried, and how we are doing our meetings so that everyone can like really defend their positions, and I would like to ask, what are we doing towards a more inclusive environment and a more diverse environment? Because I think that this is the only way that the field can really make progress. And it is also something that we should do just because it's like the only correct way of doing things.
Right, because it's right, and because it will help us make progress. Two reasons, right? Yeah. It's too bad Jarita had to leave. This is, of course, the subject of her talk, but I think we should all be able to address this. Somebody,
because I think that this is everyone's ability, but maybe we as students cannot take the risk of like talking about this everywhere. But that this should be a responsibility of professors and people that have their stability.
Yeah.
What are they doing? What are you doing?
Right. Well, what are we doing? Has anybody, I got to think of a diplomatic way to ask this question. Has anybody changed their way of doing business in the last 30 years? Francesca.
Well, first of all, maybe one of the reasons why you work in loop quantum gravity is because it's a quite diverse community. And something that I love in the tale, at least the tale that is said in this community, is that the theory would have been born without the presence of people that were very diverse, coming from different cultural background. I mean, like a Italian with a humanistic culture, and Jewish New Yorkese person, and Indian from the south of India with from Jansenist background. So all these different ways of thinking were converging together in bringing up the theory on which we work. And so, of course, these were just male guys, of course, and from very specific communities. But the idea is that quantum gravity requires all the creativity, all the possible inspirations. So of course, the more the community grows diverse, the more we will get this richness that will percolate in the new ideas and the new theory. So then how do we make this better? Well, I think that as new researchers come into the field, the more new ways of doing physics, and maybe more open to society as it is now, like a society that is more diverse, will get into the modality in which we do our research. But I wanted to say also something that is different, that is contrasting with respect to what you were saying, in the sense that you don't have to expect the change to come from the old people. It's true that old people have means, but old people were young people when they started. And when they brought change in new ways of doing research, like, as I was saying, having researchers coming from background and meeting together, becoming friends and doing research together. So in the same way, it will be you, the people who are today students will be later professors. So see yourself in that path and start now supporting the people close to you, supporting your peers, supporting the other women, the students coming from different countries, different continents, and start to change the relations between your peers, because one day you will be the professor, so you will bring these relations into the way in which you do research.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Online comment, I just want to bring that up. From a young person.
Sure, let's go online and then Chris.
Okay, Rami, go ahead.
Okay.
Can you guys hear me?
Yes.
So I would like to say thank you to you guys. I think this conference has been very inspiring to me, but maybe not in the quantum gravity sense of the word. So throughout this conference, I've been thinking, what is your form of gravity? You know, like when I heard the, you know, the quantum superposition of black holes, I couldn't help but think of, have we considered what is a gravitational self force on an accelerating entangled system? You know, have we really pushed general relativity's formalism to its logical extreme, a la DeWitt? Because when I'm listening to all of these talks on gravity, I don't see gravity anymore, you know? And it's like, as a student, it's hard to even know what problems are quantum gravity, quote unquote, or which ones are, you know, quantum general relativity, or which ones are quantum fields in curved space-time. So as a student, you know, I think it'd be pretty cool if, you know, the people who know the landscape better could define some problems in which the students can actually see, what are we assuming about what quantum gravity is? How can we see the differences in, you know, the different landscapes almost? Because I get lost in it, you know, as a relativist. I get lost in all of this, but they're really cool ideas. So anyways, I would just like to thank you guys. I'm very inspired to move forward, but maybe I don't know if it's quantum gravity because I can't even define it at this point, even after this conference. So that's the only comment I would like to make.
Good, thank you. Yeah, so Chris, you wanted to speak to her.
It's a very practical set of responses to some of the questions you raised, although it's a kind of small step in the right direction, which is there's a campaign a while ago in philosophy to have people commit to never organizing a conference where it's all senior men. I'm committed to that. I haven't ever organized a conference where it's all senior men, so it's both diverse in terms of gender representation and career stage. Niash has done a wonderful job.
Right.
So the other element is that when you're invited to a conference as a senior person, you can ask who else is being invited, so that you're also not participating in conferences that don't have an inclusive representation. And so I think, you know, those are very small practical steps, but I think that kind of thing can make for much better conferences. It gives a lot more people opportunities to participate, and it's a small step, but I think an easy one that we could take. All the senior people here could commit to saying, I'm never going to organize a conference that has a certain kind of character.
Good, yeah.
Just a quick comment. I think she was talking about the inclusivity of ideas, not the inclusivity of different people, if I understood correctly. We've been answering about the inclusivity of different groups.
No,
I thought you were talking
about of like different people,
you were
represented groups in like inter-represented groups.
I do have a comment. Yeah, I came as first.
Yeah. If I may address an elephant in the room here, I've had a few female graduate students and talked with them about why aren't there more women in physics? Obviously, as undergrads, women just do just as well as the guys do. And my impression has been that the message is that it's not that women are being suppressed by conference organizers or workshop organizers at all. What is at fault is that the system is just very much making it very hard for women to stay in the system. Because the crucial postdoc years, which is when one has to prepare for faculty applications, are like from the late 20s to mid 30s, which is not a good time to be traveling the world if you want to start a family.
Right.
And so I think it's just a very unfriendly system that we have towards women and anybody who is in a financially precarious situation, like refugees and so on. And I think that's what really needs to be addressed in order to really get to the root of what the problem is. I don't think we have to blame conference organizers here.
That's why I said it's only a small step, but it certainly...
Yeah, I mean, every little bit helps, I agree.
Yeah.
But the fundamental problem seems to be that it's just a system that is not... inclusive by design as it is now. And I think what we should perhaps consider is to go back on this stupid postdoc system and instead show some courage and hire people pretty much straight from PhD.
Right.
It's a bit of a risky thing.
So that's what happens
it ought to be, exactly.
No, that's what happens in philosophy, and it doesn't address the system in the way that you might hope. So I think if we have a system that's designed around somebody, a single person pursuing a career with no other obligations or responsibilities during their 20s or 30s, that's going to exclude a lot of people, as you said. But I don't think going away from postdocs and going direct to faculty hiring will be necessarily just because philosophy has a huge set of problems and a lot of philosophy positions.
And we have very few postdocs, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Right. Okay, but this is.
You could still have a postdoc, but if you have already lined up a tenure track position, let's say you hire into tenure track and say, by all means, go and do this postdoc there, go to do this postdoc there, because you can plan ahead if you already have a tenure track lined up.
I'm just saying, that's what the situation is in philosophy, and there's still problems. So, yeah.
The numbers are
small. Okay, well, yeah, right. So this is a question of emphasis.
I want to say, if you work in industry, then you come out of college, you've got your degree. You go get a job and maybe you're on 6 months probation, and after that 6 months probation, you're employed until you're fired or you leave. You know, why should it be different in academia?
Well, and in fact, tenure track means you have 3 years, then you have to reapply for the second 3 years, and you have applied for tenure. I think universities should have the courage to just take that risk and bet on young people when they come out.
It'd be easy if you cut salaries of faculty by a factor of two.
Hey now, hey. Come on, we're not crazy talk.
I'm just saying, if you put that to a vote of faculty, I think you might find their opinions change.
Yeah.
Junior folks are cheaper than senior folks.
What about taking the salary of the football coach using for
faculty? I don't think you have a football coach.
I mean, I would say one thing. I've thought a lot about this, but not enough. But one difference with it, right? Academia is weird. Right? We privilege tenure and job security in a way that doesn't exist in the real world. On the other hand, you know, most people don't when they go on the job market in industry do not like apply all over the world and take whatever is offered to them. You can work, you can decide to settle in an area, you can have a support system there, family, whatever. And so I think it's a little bit, what you say is true, but the situation is not quite, there's a disanalogy there too.
Well, just, no, that's true, it's not necessarily an advantage because...
What's that?
People don't necessarily, they want to be able to say, right, I've got a job here, and I'm going to start packing a life here. And if you have to, every 2 years or 3 years, go from the States to Canada to Italy to Germany, you know, I think it will be a disincentive for the best people to stay in academia.
I agree. Yeah. That's right. Okay, who else wanted to? This is an important topic. Anybody else? Niyesh?
So I just wanted to comment the point you brought about inclusivity, and I think we may not be able to solve quantum gravity in this room, but we might be able to help people who will solve quantum gravity in this room, or the people who will how people also come in this room. So I think, I have this grand dream that inclusivity, in people, and inclusivity in science, and inclusivity of ideas, that are all some unified picture or unified scheme. And then the question is, there are some obvious things that are not go against inclusivity that came up here. But there's others that are more subtle. For example, if you call yourself a string theorist, or you call yourself a loop quantum gravity person, do you mean that you're excluding people who have other ideas about the fundamental nature of space-time, or a cognoscent person for that? So I think that's an example of not being inclusive. And there are a lot of these. I mean, of course, it's good to have communities, but then every step of the day, the question is, okay, this decision I'm making, is it actually excluding people or is it including people? Or can you bring people in instead of excluding them by labels or siloing basically people into different groups? And I think that goes at the level of ideas, but also at the level of people of various backgrounds. I think it's something we should think about. And indeed, I think the point that Rob is making is a very important one, that radicalism is a risk. But then again, something that we should talk about is that how can we build, put together the supporter structure and or the planning that would support those who may come up with radical ideas. And I mean, it's not that the system is made out of us, right? We are the system. We can change the system if we decide, and we can talk about how the system can get better, and that's part of it is being inclusive in terms of women and minorities, but part of it is being inclusive of more radical ideas by putting structures in place that could support them and help them. So that's just what I'm doing.
Right, yeah. Rob?
Well, I'm quite sympathetic to the notion that the current system is developed to a case where people are basically forced to be academic nomads for quite a while until they get somewhere. So whether that favors the best or not is unclear. It certainly will favor the most determined. There are people that I'll just put up with this. I want to do this physics, and I don't care if I have to wander the world for 10 years and so on. But that being said, I have sympathy with the viewpoint here. People are going to say, what's the matter with you? Industry could fire you like that. In academia, you've got much more job security, so stop griping. So I think these are the tensions that have to be balanced. As far as the system is us, well, that's only partly true, Niyesh. It's also the government that supplies the money. So right now, I would contend in this country, we have a serious funding shortage with students and postdocs. And I would rather say, to do what you said, Akeem, instead of giving faculty positions right away, I think we just need longer. We need a much better postdoc pipeline with much firmer job security, by which I mean at least 5 years, perhaps, that it was at a decent funding level that had enough of a success rate that people saw there was a decent chance. And if the success rate is too high, you get dilution. But if it's too low, people just don't bother to compete. They just say, what's the point? So you need some balance in the middle. Right now, I would say the success rate is too low.
Mm-hmm.
Are we just postponing the inevitable if we postpone it by 5 years? Isn't it the real incentive to have tenure track?
Well, it is, but there's the study that says there are three professions that have something in common: drug dealing, entertainment, and academia. And they all have this feature that if you make it to the top, it's fantastic. Right? If you're Julia Roberts or George Clooney or a tenured professor,
Rob's drug dealer,
it's right, great. But it has all these people at the bottom that put up with all kinds of CRAP, because they dream of getting to the top, and that's what they want. And not all of them do it, but the system persists because of that. So, I mean, I didn't make this up. There's a study that's been done on this.
Yeah, yeah, it's
and,
pretty clear.
Do we want to be in that exclusive club? Do we want that?
Well, I'm not saying we want it. I'm saying this is a descriptor of what is, and so.
Okay, yeah, we actually have somebody younger who wants to say something.
So I have two questions on that. So first of all, I don't really like this notion of the most determined physics, because sometimes they are the ones that actually don't have anything else to lose. So, for example, the question I see in academia is, what are you willing to offer, or like, better, what are you willing to sacrifice in order to go there? And for example, if that implies your mental health, is it like being more determined? What are they asking for a younger generation to sacrifice? And I see like almost everything. Like, it's not about being determined. I love physics and I would choose physics over everything, but not over me. No, this me is more important than anything else in this world. So no, it's not the most determined. It's not the problem if you leave academia. Sometimes actually the problem if you stay in academia and you actually lose parts of yourself. So first one is that. And the second one is, so shortage of funding still means that you get to choose how you are going to spend the funding that you have. So the inclusivity does not come by how much funding you have. It's like how you actually choose to spend this funding. So are you open to new ideas, or you just take the ones that they are actually like, you take graduate students who are going to do the calculations that you need in order to progress your own theory or your own views. This is where inclusivity comes from, not for how much money you have, but actually how you treat the funding that you have, at least to my experience until now.
Right, and I think that's it, but it's complicated, because if you don't get funding, you don't have any postdocs or graduate students, and you have no money to offer them. So, but
of course, if you don't have anything, then the discussion is pretty trivial, because you cannot hire anyone, right?
Right.
So,
yeah.
You're going, like, by the time you have like some less than you used to have.
Yeah, it's a balance. Okay, Akeem, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's a very important point. As Rob said, the most determined will succeed in the present system. But that tends to be, guys from well-off families. That's just how it is, right? But why would we put up with this? This is not the pool of the best, obviously, right? So, and if academia wants the best, we need to make it attractive to all, just those who have the spare time and or don't care to have a family and so on.
I mean, it's like determination is like, in some broad terms, I don't really know if I agree with the determination part. It's, for example, just imagine like a typical student who would spend their whole life in academia, right? And then they turn into 30s, and then they don't know anything else about the outside world. So are they determined to do physics, or are they too afraid to go to the outside world? So is it determination or fear that keeps you there? So it's not always determined. It's the ones sometimes that they don't have another choice, or at least they think they don't have another choice. The ones that think they have another choice, most of the time just
Okay, so. Yeah. Okay. So Francesca, and then we'll.
Sure. Are we sure we really want the best? Because meritocracy is a concept that comes with danger. So how you define it? So just I leave it there. Maybe we don't want the best. We want something that's have diversity.
Wait, Francesca, not the best, then what? What's your first function if it's not
the nicest people?
The point is that the definition. So if the old generation defines what is the best could be just a replication of the old people.
Right.
This will not bring diversity. Will not bring new ideas.
That does. There are studies that show that does happen. Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah, we overestimate our ability to judge talent, I think.
Well, not the people here.
No, we know what we're doing. Okay, well, about 3:30, and we have some more beverages and stuff downstairs. Is that correct, Niyesh?
All the leftovers from the week.
Great. All right. Well, thanks, everybody, for coming. And thank you, Niyesh, for putting this together.